Our next speaker is Ron Forman from the University of Florida. Page 2 of your handout, we have a bio on him. Director of Afro-American Studies and Associate Professor of English and Graduate Studies at the University of Florida in Gainesville. So Ron Forman will speak on the role of the Negro Writers Unit in Florida. Ron.
But not until the Cam Carter unit gets here, so. And not here, so I'll go on. Of necessity, you are going to hear, as you have heard, some overlays of material today, and it seems impossible not to do that. The preceding presentation was extremely thorough, and I am in full approval of the comprehensiveness of it, just as I have been of the other presentations today, listening to Alan Jabbour and listening to Lomax and listening to the materials having to do with archival recovery, remind me of how much we do things that relate to one another and to each other, even when we have special niches to get into. The role of the Negro Writers Unit in Florida must be seen at once in what those blacks employed by the Florida Writers Project did, and may be interpreted against the shifting turns and directives, and at the beginning, against the continuing fixed view which many Americans held of the nation's coloreds or Negroes in the years before and during the Depression. So it is that the traversal of these conference proceedings, as we have heard and will yet hear them, pulls together from among us those who were there, those who know where the archival artifacts of a genuinely fascinating national experience are, and all of us who continue to assess and to honor the past and present. We have a chronicle of people surviving, sometimes as subjects of reports and as gatekeepers for reporters, interacting briefly with the privileged, occasionally acting to dissemble or evade or entertain, sometimes acting to affirm what is believed and practiced as honored. The Florida outline of its Negro Writers Unit emerges from the archival materials utilized by researchers and specialists. Data from WPA records, a familiar storage box is box 200, show for the Florida Writers Project figures of 10 blacks employed in 1936 and 1937. That number, Stetson Kennedy's invaluable records and recall affirm, represented the quota established in the initial year, 1935, of the hiring of blacks for Florida's project. Stetson shares these particulars about the inaugural period of operations. The Negro unit was located in the Clara White Mission, a memorial charity established for Clara White's mother, a pioneer black leader, Mrs. Eartha M. White, on West Ashley Street in Jacksonville. There was little, if any, contact between staff of the state FWP office, also located in Jacksonville, and staff of the Negro unit. At the earliest, two black field workers, Paul Diggs of Lakeland, who reported to the FWP Tampa district office by mail, and Zora Neale Hurston, who from Eatonville reported sometimes in person to State Director Dr. Corita Doggett Koss in Jacksonville, were part of the Negro unit staff. By 1937, you've heard, three field workers were principally responsible for research and writing leading to the manuscript known as the Florida Negro. In this period, a letter of information directed to W.T. Couch, an FWP regional director at the University of North Carolina, the letter is dated December 27, 1938, identifies three Negro employees, Ruth Bolton, a stenographer, Paul Diggs, a field worker who gathers life histories, folklore, and material for the Negro book, and Zora Neale Hurston, who is, quote, employed as field worker and editor of the Negro book. Ruth Bolton and Paul Diggs earn every 2 weeks $72.50 and $72.80, respectively. Hurston is paid $67.20, explained in a parenthetical note which cites the rate as being the professional rate in Orange County. Prior to the correspondence just cited, Couch had received a memorandum from the Federal Writers Project Office on Negro Affairs, dated October 19, 1938, detailing the status of reporting and essay preparation on black subjects in the states of Alabama, Florida, Georgia, North Carolina, South Carolina, Virginia, and Tennessee. For Florida, State Director Koss mentioned the quota change, which reduced the Negro unit from 10 to 8 to 3 employees. The Office on Negro Affairs, hereafter ONA summary, noted that Florida, quote, had submitted an excellent essay, Negroes in Florida, in 1937, and reported that, quote, at present, workers in this office are engaged in writing inserts for final Florida copy. There is to be a publication on the Negroes in Florida, and we understand Ms. Zora Neale Hurston is connected with this work. As an aside, it is useful to mention that ONA's memorandum of this date observes that Alabama's FWP had undergone a fruitless effort to find certified Negroes in Macon County, that is Tuskegee Institute's county, capable of performing the FWP work required, and that North Carolina's FWP had not employed Negro workers, though the state director was planning to use one, quote, very intelligent colored man in covering, quote, an interesting Negro community. The inclusion of Zora Neale Hurston among the blacks employed by the Florida Workers Writers Project and the assignment given her to direct the compilation of the materials on black life in Florida point to what was and to what might have been achieved. As with the materials gathered in the 16 or so chapters of the yet unpublished The Negro in Florida, 1528 to 1940, the stamp of Hurston's expressive and intellectual gifts continues to invest her life's work with heightened significance. You've heard that there are several versions of this manuscript. The version in the library, Florida History Library at the University of Florida, is a Xerox of a Xerox, about 147 pages, and we've heard had conversation in recent days about variations in the length and variations in the form of this manuscript. Dr. Corse, reviewing years later her own involvement in the Florida Writers Project, explained, quote, "I wish that we had given Zora Hurston, an outstanding Pulitzer Prize winner on Negro folklore, the editorial responsibility for the Negro book. In the state offices, it didn't occur to us, and neither was it suggested by Washington, but we would have had a book, an outstanding book, if we had done this. And further," Dr. Corse reasoned, "I should have realized, and I believe that other Writers Project staff should have realized, but she was 40 years ahead of her time. The issue of materials reported, recorded, and interpreted of those elected by investigations of investigators, but removed from presentation by staff and editorial managers, remains an important consideration in collaborative approaches to strengthening studies in cultural history. A fine balance does exist between faithful documentation and dispassionate explanation. An equally challenging task is that effort to reconstruct the settings in which the surviving elements of such records as we have been considering today were generated. Wherever it is possible, investigations must encourage and combine oral recall with our boxes and sheaves of Xeroxed papers. For the folklife studies to which we are committed, the time has grown short for the reminiscences which we need to have and must value. And small wonder, the fire dance to which the federal writers in Florida invited Floridians, presented in connection with the new national folklore studies of the Federal Writers Project Works Progress Administration, for which the players were a Florida troupe of black singers and dancers, and for which the dance director was Zora Neale Hurston, took place in Orlando on January 25th, 1939, just 50 years ago. May we yet be in the nick of time.
Thank you, Ron. Our next speaker, Barbara Spiceman. I'm sorry. A professor of English at Florida A&M University, has studied the life and works of Zora Neale Hurston for several years. So please, Dr. Spiceman.
Before I begin what I was going to say, Dr. Foreman, I was at Rollins College 2 weeks ago on Martin Luther King's birthday, and I've been looking for a copy of Zora's play From Sun Up to Sundown, and I thought, well, if it's anywhere, it has to be at Rollins. So I've been talking there and seeing if I could find a copy, and they said, no, there's no copy. And I cannot find a copy in Florida, but I did look at the program and the reviews that it got at that time, and they had my play, Zora and Marjorie, was being performed there, and they had pictures of Zora and her attachment to Rawlings, and then Marjorie Rawlings and her attachment. Marjorie was winning a very prestigious award, the White Rider, and Zora was simply being recognized for working like the devil to put that play on. And, of course, Marjorie's works are all in the library, and Zora's play, as far as I can find in Florida, is very difficult to locate. And it's basically the same play that she did in New York at that time. I think she kept writing versions of it, but it must be somewhere. So you folklore people out there, see if you can find it. Back to the Depression, the way we started the afternoon. And Stetson talking about the 30s. Well, I'm going to do something Zora never did, which was admit her age and say that I was a Depression baby. And my folks came from Chicago. My dad was pretty sick. And they bought, sight unseen, some land, now Route 60, but at the time it was Route 30 in swampland. And they had a little one-room shack. And while Stetson was up hooting and hollering in Key West, I was crawling around the one-room shack. I remember my parents used to bring in once a week, we were poor, a box with our groceries. And every Saturday night, I'd go look in that box and see if there might be some candy there. I had some friends, and they weren't crackers. They were Indians. Seminole Indians, two little girls, and I remember them. They were Bessie and Susie, and we played with their dolls, and later on I had turkeys, and I named my turkeys after Bessie and Susie, and we had a Tom turkey, and one day Bessie and Susie and Tom were shot, and I was so heartbroken because it seemed, well, I'd never see my little friends again. I don't know where they went. There went Bessie, and there went Susie, and there went Tom. But anyway, that's one of my claims, I think, to being here today. Another is that for over 20 years, I've taught English at Florida A&M University, which was an all-black school in Tallahassee, Florida. When I first went there, and this was before Martin Luther King was assassinated, I was really amazed with the dialect of my students, and when I realized that I was being brought there to teach them to write standard English, and then what they were writing seemed so much better to me than any standard English I've ever read, I felt dismay. And unfortunately, over the years, I've seen that beautiful dialect vanish, because when I went there, many of the sayings of Zora Neale Hurston were still being written and spoken by those students. And I can't say the same anymore. It's just the same bad English that everybody else uses. So my premise today is a little bit different. My premise is that Zora Neale Hurston and Marjorie Kenan Rawlings both had much greater ambitions. So it is a very noble ambition to be a folklorist, a collector. They wanted to be an artist. And this was the beauty about them and their tragedy as well. First, I want to tell you a little bit about Marjorie and how she came to Florida. And I know you know the old story. This may be a little different twist on it. Marjorie, in the 20s, had worked as a newspaper reporter and had a column entitled Songs of the Everyday Housewife, in which she wrote the most miserable little poems about cleaning and cooking and making pies. She had married her college sweetheart, Charles Rawlings. She had gotten Phi Beta Kapp at the University of Wisconsin. But we have one miserable lady. She was past 30. She felt she was a complete failure. She had tried for over 20 years, since she was a little girl, to publish her work. She wanted to be a writer. She wanted to write stories. She wanted to write novels. Not one published. Not one considered. Not one accepted. She came to Florida in 1928. She was met by a woman called Zelma Kaysen, who later was going to be her nemesis, her inspiration, and finally the lady that took her to her doom. Zelma Kaysen took Marjorie all around the backwood territory of Central Florida, the Ocala scrub country, the area around Cross Creek. She spent a few weeks there, listened to Zelma, and was determined, by God, she had found her material. She went back to New York, took what money she had, bought sight unseen the 72 acres in Cross Creek, Florida, and she and her husband came and settled. She started again to follow her friend Zelma Kaysen as she took the census around Cross Creek. Marjorie listened carefully. She was a good reporter. She observed and she wrote. And she wrote something that is called Cracker Chitlings, C-H-I-D-L-I-N-G-S. And that, of course, is a phonetic pronunciation of chitterling. I have some copies in the back, so if you want to look at this before you leave, because I want you to observe that all this is a collection of folk incidents from people that she is seeing, observing, and then writing about. She observed such stories as a very famous preacher of the time who went to the congregation around Cross Creek, and he was warned that the congregation was going to treat him like a nigger, quote, quote, and they did. Marjorie mentioned a name, Harry Barnes, as being a bad boy in the neighborhood, and that the reverend had left this area around Cross Creek to, instead of staying there, to go to Rayford Prison because he thought that was preferable. And before he left, said to his sinful congregation, where I go, I hope you two may come soon. Now, one mistake, not mistake, but it was going to cause Marjorie some trouble later, was using direct names of people. Harry Barnes was a young man in the area. He'd been in the First World War, had been wounded, and died in a terrible, terrible accident shortly before Marjorie published her chitlings. So by using these direct names, Marjorie was beginning to do something that was going to cause problems later on and was going to finally be the reason why she could no longer write about the subject matter at Cross Creek. But the chitlings, if you observe it, is simply little incidents, pieces of folk tales, local color. It has no real organization. It has no real artistic merit. What it does show is her good ear for being a reporter. Now, Cracker Chitlings does, however, hold the elements of many of the qualities that she would later take and emerge into her beautiful, wonderful novels, such as The Yearling and Cross Creek. But first, what Marjorie had to do was to become her own folk heroine. She had to so immerse herself in her material that she became part of the folk tale, a Florida folk heroine. When she was able to do this, when she was able to bridge the gap of the tale, and then Marjorie, the persona that she wanted to be, she was able to enter into what she considered to be real literature. This is the Marjorie as she came to be, and it's very, very different from the Marjorie that wrote Songs of the Everyday Housewife. It's an article she wrote called Yesterday's Woman, an exclusive interview by Lollipop Twitter. This was one of her names that she, when she talked to her husband, Norton, she liked to use. I drew up at the little village to ask my way. Already I sensed the mystic quality of the region made famous by the woman I searched for. A hog ran squealing from under a jalopy, and the driver leaned over to spit after it. "Mrs. Rawlings," I asked hesitantly, "which way to the riding seat of Marjorie Keenan Rawlings?" I knew instinctively that the man I addressed was one of her beloved characters. "Who?" he said. "Oh, that bitch. First I knowed she'd done it with her seat." He looked at me curiously. "She's expecting you, lady. She sure as hell will shoot the pants off you if she ain't. But it's your business, 4 miles west." Sure now of my welcome, for I was not expected, I drove happily west. There was no mistaking the place. It could only be the shrine I sought. Sure now of my welcome, I came. The odor of fresh fertilizer was wafted to me on the afternoon breeze. I got out at the gate. A friendly black and white bird dog came to me and lifted his leg against me. We went merrily up the path together. An old colored mammy answered my knock and my question. "She's here, missy. She's having one of her fits. She was right drunk last night. 'Tain't her fault. She's as pure as a lily. She just got 10 down friends comes out here and gets her drunk." So this is the persona that Marjorie eventually became, and a lot of people believe that when you see Cross Creek, the movie, or The Yearling, that this is Marjorie. However, the real Marjorie is a very difficult woman to find, and I'll get into that after I go through a little bit about Zora Hurston, because what Zora Hurston did is basically the same as Marjorie. Zora, remember, left Eatonville when she was a kid. We don't know quite where she was. She lied about her age so much, it's hard to figure out how old she was or where she was. But we know that if she was not a born adventurer, by the time she was mature, she had to become one. Zora eventually wound up in New York as one of the stars of the Harlem Renaissance, where she played one of her major roles as being the primitive. She was trying to become an anthropologist. She was terribly interested in folklore. She did not quite know yet, I don't think, her approach to the subject. She got very sick of New York. She did not like the New York scene. She did not like being the pet of Von Vechten or Fanny Hurst or these other characters. And she wrote something at the time that was published. This is shortly before Marjorie's Cracker Chitlins. Zora wrote something called the Eatonville Anthology. Now, the Eatonville Anthology, if you put the two side by side, are written in almost the same disjointed form, using short incidents, of folklore and folk life. And what Zora was doing was remembering. She was remembering at the turn of the century or whenever, when she was a child in Eatonville. But the Eatonville Anthology and the Cracker Chitlins both showed women using their folklore and their folk life, but not in an artistic form. Now, what Zora decided to do with her anthology was to go back to Eatonville, to go back there and settle for a while and see what she could do with her material. Now, if you study the two carefully, the Chitlins and the anthology, you will see the basic difference between the two women. The Chitlins deal with Zora's impression of the black male. This is a prominent theme in the Eatonville anthology. And it shows a great bitterness. The very first incident is Mrs. Roberts, the pleading woman. She is pleading for something to eat. And she says, "My husband doesn't feed me. Give me something to eat. My husband doesn't feed me." Now, the very next incident given in the anthology is about a woman not getting enough to eat from her husband, but not getting enough recognition from her husband. He beats her. She goes to church, and she sings in the choir, and she sings louder and louder, and she comes home, and he beats her harder and harder. She says, "Well, I'll get my way back at him some way. I can sing even louder still." Another one, which was going to evolve into Their Eyes Are Watching God, is the story of Mrs. Clark, who Janie eventually becomes, Zora eventually becomes Janie, who was Mrs. Clark at the turn of the century at Joe Clark's store. Well, Mrs. Clark, too, is mistreated by her husband. And he pulls her hair. He curses her. So if you look at the anthology, which is supposed to be such a funny piece, this is often regarded as one of Zora Hurston's comical pieces of writing. And if you really look at the theme, it may be the dialect is funny, but the subject matter certainly is not comical. And another name is used, Psych Jones, over and over again. And Psych Jones, he too beats his wife, and he beats his dog. Now, that's low to beat your dog. But that is about the dog, Tippy. And the dog has been abused by everybody in Eatonville, and they've all tried to do away with him. But the dog still continues to live. Now, this is sort of interesting with Psych Jones. In a class of mine, it was a women in literature class, and one of the students came and said, you know, my uncle was, she was from Eatonville, she said, my uncle is named Sykes Jones.